Adrian, Petrina, Lisa.
So by the number of questions we had even before the session now in the break, I can see it's going to be interesting discussion. So I will try to keep my introduction short. And if you feel that this meeting is a bit of a deja vu of what we have discussed in February last year, let me assure you, even though it's similar, it's different as well, because what we talked about last year was possibility of going down the route of whether there are two types of leases, and then which accounting approach would be appropriate for leases that are considered other than financing leases, what we called it then. If I remember correctly, you trashed that approach, I think, and so did boards a couple of months later. However, what happened since is that we have heard a lot of concerns, particularly from the preparer community, on the perceived front-loading impact that the decisions that were proposed in 2010 ED and that are current tentative decisions by the boards on subsequent measurement of the right of use asset would create. And, you know, in simple terms, why this front-loading effect arises is because our liability to make lease payment is measured using effective interest method, so interest is higher in initial period, the lower later as we pay it off. But our right of use asset would typically be amortized on a straight line basis, i.e. same expense in each period. So when you add those two together, obviously the initial expense at the beginning of the lease is higher than at the end. Now, on a portfolio level, this may not matter, but there are always, and there will always be companies that have a significant number of leases that start at the same time, or they have a portfolio which is experiencing significant changes, either growth or decline. And for those companies, this front-loading effect may have consequences on their income statement. So the boards have asked us to consider whether there are any alternative approaches that would deal with this. But the starting point this time, unlike the last year, is not to go down the route of two types of leases, but it is really to look whether we can find one approach that could be made appropriate for all these contracts and that would perhaps deal with some of these concerns. So we came up with two. Well, we actually had a thing about four to start with. We now have two. It's got better limit the discussion. So if you could maybe also in the discussion stick to the two that were here in this paper. So I'm just going to briefly summarize them. So, I mean, I'm saying two because approach A is the current court's decisions, which I just explained. Approach B is what we refer to interest-based amortization method. And this is basically the method in which we measure the right of use asset at the present value of the remaining benefits that are expected to flow from that asset. So in other way, even though we look at the benefits that we expect in each period, we don't, even if benefits are expected to be same, we don't amortize it at the same amount because we take into account time value of money. So this results in amortization lower in initial period of the lease and higher amortization charge towards the end of the lease. And when you combine this together with the interest expense profile, if you have a lease where pattern of payments for your lease liability is same as the pattern of benefits you receive from the right of use asset, this will give you a straight line profile. And in most of the leases, this is the case because typically your lease payments represent the benefits that you consume in that period. So I will not say much more on that approach. You can ask questions. And finally, the second approach, second alternative we are considering here is approach C, which is the labeled as underlying asset approach. And this approach is basically looking at how a sewer prices the contract in the when the lease is priced. And how lessor prices the contract is that lessor looks at three components. Lessor prices contract for the value of the asset that's going to be used up during the lease term, so the difference in the value from the beginning and the end. The lessor prices the receivable, which is, it earns interest on that receivable, which is the present value of lease payments, and the lessor also earns interest on the residual asset because the entire investment in the lease is utilized by the lessee during the lease term. So when we look at these three components, you can actually see that in different types of leases, the expense profile would be different. Because I think maybe best now if you look at these examples so we can relate to the, this is on pages 6 and 7. So if we start with simple one, an example of land, so typically we assume that the land's value does not change, that the land's, the land does not amortize. So this means that there is no, in the lessor's pricing, there is no charge for the amortization of the land. The only charge the lessor makes is the interest on the receivable, which is the interest on lessee's lease liability, plus the interest on the residual asset. And because one interest is increasing, the other one is increasing, as you can see on the, so this is the third sort of bucket under approach C. So interest on lease obligation is obviously decreasing, and amortization expense is increasing because in this case amortization expense represents that interest payment on the residual asset, and our total lease expense is actually straight line over the lease term. But in the case of equipment, you can see the profile is quite different. So on the example on page 6, what we have is we are assuming that 50% of the value of that equipment is consumed during that lease term. So in the amortization expense for the equipment lease, you not only have the interest on the residual, which has this increasing profile, but you also have this straight line component of the depreciation of the underlying asset, and therefore the overall expense profile is less of a straight line and more like the current board decisions, but it is not as sort of steep as current board's decision because of the impact of interest on the residual asset. Now, I hope this was clear, at least as a starting point for discussion, because this approach is perhaps the newest of all. You may want to ask some questions, but I don't want to take any more time in explanations, but I'm going to leave this to you for questions and for discussion on your opinions on this.
So we discussed this with the working group for the lease project, and there was support for all of the three methods. I think B was perhaps slightly the slightly more support than A. C didn't get a massive amount of support. Some saw the theoretical logic of it, but thought it was complicated, very different, maybe not
practical. Actually, Steve, as the working group day progressed, towards the end of the day, there was more support for the C than at the beginning. So depending which part of the day,
it did progress. And Jed wasn't there to persuade them, but he did provide us with input beforehand. And Jed was very much in favour of alternative C, weren't you?
And it was slightly different than this one, but not very. But yeah, underlying C, I much prefer.
And it's also fair to say that, by the way, what you haven't seen us here is we have some staff recommendations for the board next week, and also the staff are divided amongst all three approaches. And so we're hoping you will provide us with some more unanimity in your views possibly around this.
Okay. Comments, questions?
I would favor the approach three, where the user underlying a certain set approach, because the main reason for having a standard on leasing is to present assets as they were bought, so as they were depreciated in house. So I would keep the same goal of keeping as I really economically financially bought the assets. So I want to have the same image.
Could I just ask you a follow-up to that? Maybe this is related to Jed's point on the difference between original and this approach. Because if you were to buy underlying asset, the interest you show in the income statement would be the interest on the underlying asset. Whereas in this approach, we have combined interest under the residual component with the amortization, with the charge for the amortization of the underlying asset. So we have combined this together and presenting as amortization of the right of use. So even though the logic in terms of the pattern of the expense is the same as the underlying asset, because we are not recognizing liability for the residual, because there is no liability for the residual, there is therefore no total interest expense which is comparable as if you were buying that underlying asset, if that makes sense. So would that still resonate with you?
I had not thought to that question, sorry.
It's effectively the underlying asset approach with some netting.
Yeah.
Netting off the underlying asset with the obligation to return that asset.
Yeah, but in the for me, the goal would be in the case where you have a, you use 100% of an asset, you will deliver the same image.
Yes.
Which I believe is the, should be one of the main goals of the standard.
And that's, that was always been my position. I preferred the whole asset or the modified whole. Mm-hmm. I mean, the issue that you've got is the approach C, I think, is probably more operational than the whole asset approach, because in the whole asset approach you have to have a view on what the residual value is that you're going to return to the lessor, and that's hard to determine. And the other thing is you get very strange answers in the it doesn't really work, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, I'm rather new, but almost on the verge of suggesting a fourth.
So this working group will endorse that one as well.
If I look at these calculations and I see at the heading land 0% consumption, it's somehow. It doesn't feel right that there is depreciation then, because if you had the asset itself is not depreciated, and I'd like to concur with Jacques on that. Basically, you're not renting, or you're not had the asset utilization is the entire piece of land, and the value of that land is probably, well, if you pay, what is it? 66 million, whatever, a year, is probably maybe 1,000. So what I would say is you add an asset of 1,000 on the balance sheet, you have a liability for the amounts that you are due to pay, and in case of land, that's all interest, and you have a obligation to return the land to the owner at the end of the period, which is probably then like 750 at the end of the lease term. But
well, hopefully it should be higher. You've had it for 5 years and it's a piece of land. Hopefully land values have gone up by inflation. But
that doesn't come to you, so
exactly.
But that's
okay. So yeah. You're describing Jed's approach.
Yeah, my original approach, which is the whole asset approach.
Which is the whole asset, a gross stuff.
And if you look at equipment 50% consumption, my approach would have been that the amortization expense would have been 100 in each period, because you're using one-tenth of an asset worth 1,000 and has a 10-year useful economic life. So the depreciation charge, which you'd have if you were a corporate who bought it, would be 100 each year. And the interest on the lease obligation would have gone 60, 55, 49, and so forth. So that in the final, in year six, it would have been, if you'd extended it, it would have been 30, because you had an asset that was worth 500 at that stage, your cost of capital is still 6, so your interest charge in the following year should have been 30.
Yeah. And just to say that under approach C, at the total expense level, it is exactly the same number, but where the difference comes in is that obviously in that split between amortization and interest, or depreciation and interest. And what you've described, by the way, it's not that we think that, you know, the reason we've done it in this way is because we think that's nonsense or wouldn't provide better information. It's more that as we've worked through this, that to do that more grossed up whole asset approach would require the lessee really to have access to either, you know, fair value information for what it's, you know, every lessee for fair value information for what it's leasing, either at the start or know what it is at the end and monitor that. And I suppose we've concluded that we think that that's probably something we can't quite get to propose a model that will require a lessee in every situation to have that information.
So, I'd like So if I understand correctly, C is Jed's pet project.
No. D was.
Okay, but
the whole asset one.
But you've had to
C's the closer compromise.
Okay. So, and if we seriously want to say C is the right answer, we have to address a couple of things. First of all, the lease payment is 149 in this example. People still use the EBITDA for a proxy for cash, or the income statement for a proxy of cash. And standard setters are generally accused of having very theoretically cute models that have, you know, are just way away from economics. And I think we actually have to do a very good job of explaining. You have to address those front and center if you really want C to have a chance of surviving, because I can hear the screaming. Incidentally, just so everybody knows, I love the appeal of, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's an asset, whether you bought it or you rent it. That intellectually is very comforting. I'm just looking at that 149 going, oh boy, be careful what you wish for. So how would you address, as a user, how would you address the 149 problem? What you're advocating is an income statement number that's disconnected from what they're actually paying on the lease.
Well, to be honest with you, I never look at EBITDA.
Okay.
because depreciation is an expense,
but,
and you need
okay. That's true. Yeah. That's true, but there are a whole bunch of analysts that are forced
you're
to.
You're a lucky guy, because what are you looking at? because we have provided it, let's be honest.
There are a lot of analysts that have no choice because
yes.
What they're dealing with, they have to deal with EBITDA, even among analysts that should know better.
I mean, it's a fact.
So, Rob, you're saying that the rent is 149, that's what they're paying, that should be the expense?
No. I'm not actually saying that. I looked at this and I said, the gaming wheels just starts because of this industry, because of the history, that you can't look at the stuff without starting to think game. And that's why I think C finally shuts down all of the interminable questions about whether it was leased, whether it was bought, all the internal issues within an organization. And I don't want to say disclosure is the answer to this problem either. If we as a group want to say C, we have to really say why 149 is wrong, and the EBITDA is fair for half the analysts, it's not fair for the other half. And it's you're the advocate. You've never been forced to look at EBITDA ever.
Let's see what the others think about the different methods. Dennis?
No, just in general, this is just one illustration of the general issue with cash versus income statement. So why this is not any different from the fact that some analysts think that the service cost is a cash item in the income statement. So it's that not something we just should try to explain why there is a difference between the cash and the income statement recognition. So. There are other areas where the same issue arises, and we kind of accept that, and we're not addressing that because we feel that analysts and investors will not understand the difference between cash and accrual.
A deferred tax is something very common. It does exist.
But don't get me wrong, it's an important point, but it's kind of an issue that has much more bigger implications than simply discussing in the context of leasing. So it's just an issue of explaining why the cash number is different from the income statement.
Okay, I'm going to put you all on notice that I'm going to ask you to vote at the end of this. So be thinking about it as we're discussing. So somebody to advocate A? I want to get Saichi on.
I think this is the most simple way. And also, as explained earlier, that in the portfolio basis over the long run, no matter what, methods that you take, basically over the years it will be the same. And if that is the case, I think I'm attracted to the simpleness of this
This is not an all. This is not at all a transition issue.
No, it puts to one side the whole transition problem. Say that we've just solved that. This is ongoing.
Steve, can I just? Before even considering it, I'm just still confused with what the base assumptions are. And the more I look at the data, the more confused I am. For example, I'm just again trying to look at the numbers because I'm just trying to see what the numbers telling me. Because the conceptual approach is what they struggle with. And for example, approach A seems to be amortizing the assets for more than its residual value. So I'm just trying to ground it to my own understanding of accounting, and it just doesn't seem to work for me. So can you just go back and walk us through, and I don't mind if everybody's clear on that, that's fine. But I'm at the much more rudimentary question.
I think how
this works.
The key thing to remember is that the residual value of the asset is only relevant in C. So in A, all you're doing is saying future lease payments are this, present value is whatever it is, 626. That's the right of use asset. That's the obligation. Depreciate the right of use asset from 626 to zero over 5 years. Amortize the obligation on the basis of the repayments.
So this is simply A is, A is not, all right.
So A is what we had in the exposure draft. A is how we do finance lease accounting at the moment.
Okay, so let's take it to C. So now even with C, you're depreciating more than 500.
That's because there's an element of interest embedded in that depreciation. So the depreciation of the underlying is the 500, and then there's an extra 126 of interest added in, because effectively you are getting finance for the whole asset. Effectively, you're borrowing the whole asset, and then you have to return part of that asset at the end. So that's why you get to 626.
So it's made up of 500. You mesh interest on the assets with, and including the amortization, rather than including in the interest.
Yeah, which could be separated out in the notes, for example.
Again, it just muddies the presentation. I cannot decipher what's going on here based on just looking at the numbers.
That's one of the criticisms of C.
Why is it combined within the amortization charge?
It was basically, as I explained, because I mean we could, as we say, because to get to these numbers, there's two pieces behind it. There's the depreciation and the interest piece. It's just that when we've run the numbers, if we were going to ask lessees to split it out even in the notes or in presentation, it would require the lessee to have quite accurate information about the fair value of the underlying asset, either at the start of the lease and at the end of the lease. And that's where we thought that's where I think that people in the past and even now would argue that approach, that whole asset approach, is non-operational for lessees. You know, if we required every lessee to have that fair value information about the underlying asset, whereas by netting it, all the lessee needs to have is to be able to estimate that, you know, percentage decrease in value. And when we've run the numbers as well, we think it's more operational in this way, because you can have quite a bit of estimation error and still at this net level not have a significant, you know, effect on the numbers recognized. It was an operationality issue, not anything else.
Anybody think B is clearly the right answer?
Well, approach B has the great, great benefit of being simple to understand from a sort of P&L perspective, which the conversations I've had with investors, a whole wide range of opinions, but one of the things that's quite commonly come back to me is, well, why are they doing this? Okay, so I need to see a liability. Yeah, okay, fair enough, that's useful, so I don't have to do my own capitalization, I can just get a number. But then why are they mucking around with a P&L account? I'm happy with the P&L is a common pushback. So the P&L basically is rent cash cost goes through the P&L, end of story. And I think it seems to me that approach B would satisfy the needs of quite a lot of users in terms of presenting a liability so they don't have to work it out themselves, or at least they've got a starting point, but then also giving them a P&L number which they can sort of intuitively relate to, at least. I mean, you know, you can understand, here's an amortization profile we're doing effectively on a sort of mortgage repayment basis. So it's that sort of profile, so that, if you like, we get to the right overall answer in terms of a P&L cost that matches cash. So you can sort of tell that, you know, things are being fiddled around a little bit to get to the end result you want. But I think a lot of users,
intuitively will start with that P&L number and then refer to the balance sheet rather than starting with the balance sheet and then trying to understand the P&L cost. And so if you give them, well, either A or C, they've then got to do quite a lot of thinking, particularly with C, a lot of thinking about what actually does that P&L number represent, what do those P&L numbers really represent.
But do you think in approach B, one number is appropriate rather than splitting it out between imputed interest and amortization, or just having a rent expense if you went for approach B?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know. It's probably the simple answer. It's hard to tell, really. I mean, at the moment, people get one rental number, and if they're wanting to capitalise, they add back all of that number. So they go sort of EBIT DAP, or you know, they go to a pre operating lease expense profit figure, and then they will try and put the capitalised value of the liability into their sort of valuation sum of the parts or whatever.
How would you measure EBIT?
Second.
How would you measure EBIT under approach B? Would it be after the amortization before the interest or after the whole thing?
Well, I would probably, just do it after the EBIT. Yeah, so I'd expense the amortization, but before the interest element is what I would start with. I'd need to think about that more to sort of work out whether that was really a sensible measure of EBIT. That's what I would do as a simplistic point, and I suspect that's what most people would do. So if you present it as interest and amortization, most people will say, right, well, if that's interest, then it shouldn't be an EBIT.
We have shown the five years lease in example, and therefore I think B seems okay. But if this was the 30 years genuine finance lease, I think B will bring us with the significant front underload. That's, I think, could be the problem for us.
I was going to say, with what do we do to derive operating leases as the organisation I work for? And what we do is we try and look at what the underlying nature of the asset is. And so if it's property rentals, we say actually almost all of that is a financial remuneration to the lessor, and an EBIT would be, if we were capitalising those rental payments in our enterprise value, we wouldn't have any deduction from the EBIT. EBIT would be EBIT with all the rent added back. If it's a business that consumes them, so construction equipment and stuff that effectively is that a big chunk of the operating lease payment is a payment for the diminution or the use of some of the useful economic life of that asset, then we try and disaggregate how much of it is financing and how much of it is genuine consumption of the asset. Because what we're trying to do in the P&L typically is look at the nature of the expense, not necessarily the function. So we're looking at the nature of it, and we're saying that a rental payment by its nature is two discrete components: financial remuneration to the lessor and utilization of an asset.
Vincent, look like you want to.
I would say for me the list was be the first approach A. It's a somewhat struggle with the approach B. I'm uncomfortable with the whole idea of inextricably linking how you're treating assets and liabilities. And I'm also not convinced that from a P&L standpoint, the information you're getting has any higher predictive value in terms of just ensuring that it's steady over time. It does not necessarily reflect the pattern of cash flows in all instances, and thus I'm not sure whether it's got any higher predictive value. And approach C, it's rather complex. So the least worst really would be the first approach. But having said that, I think there are the issues around how you're treating the amortization of the intangible asset there, which I may not necessarily agree with either. But given the three options, I still would tilt towards approach A.
Well, this has raised a lot of passions, as you might imagine. Many of the preparers, particularly those with the property leases, saying anything other than B is just crazy and makes no sense to move away from the rent. Fair to say that many of the standard setter, particularly the accounting firms, I think the accounting firms pretty much all in approach A, feel that conceptually it's pretty difficult to justify B or C. The board is split on this. FASB, I think, is split on it. It'll be a key question in the re-exposure, whichever way we go and however we do it. But I'm very interested in the balance of views here, given that you've heard a fairly short discussion on it and people advocating one or another. So I'm going to ask you to vote, and we'll see what sort of balance we get for A, B, and C.
One vote each.
First preference. And Daryl can't vote. Okay, who's going to vote for A? Got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 for A. Who's going to vote for B? 1, 2, and C? 1, 2, 3, 4. I nearly
Sorry. I'd like to just brief. I voted for A, but from a tactical point of view.
You don't like Jed?
No. Actually, I'd like to disagree with him as a matter of principle, but this time, conceptually, he's right, and so he needs to be given its due. The reason what I noticed is that A is a dirty answer. It's very close to, in the examples we've shown, it's very close to C. And I'm wondering whether the added complexity, the added questions, the added issue is worth the small difference.
Not where you haven't consumed the asset. It's then like B.
In case of equipment, it's close.
Look at the land example.
Yeah.
The whole point. And it's number six. It solves the issue for retailers.
Mm. Yeah. Okay.
The
you have a point.
That's the big attraction of C. Yeah.
So,
retail problem.
Are you changing
one of the most passionate people on the working group in favor of A was a preparer, but it was a big ticket equipment lessee preparer. And he was comparing lease versus purchased. I buy the asset, I have depreciation interest, I lease it. I should have exactly the same depreciation interest because my decisions is one of, do I lease these great big trucks in his mine or do I buy them?
So it's, if you're right, if you flip the next page.
You change your vote now?
Yeah, I do. Sorry.
What are you now voting, Rob?
Jed's right. Jed's right. When he's right, he's right.
Yeah. Do you want to roll, Jed? So what does that make the final vote?
5-2-5.
5-2-5.
Oh. Very helpful.
How much do you want to pay for my vote?
Yes, sold.
Cheap. May I try on the two B votes? If you vote for B, then you have accepted that we have gradually increasing depreciations. So you start by low depreciations and you go for high depreciations. This opens up for very nice gaming. So you say, should I lease or should I buy, depending on your situation. And therefore, a consequential discussion would be that we introduce also progressive depreciations when you buy. Will you still vote for B? If that is a consequence?
So that if all assets you bought, you would have to apply a depreciation policy where...
Yeah, lots of people are saying, we shouldn't have this with a linear depreciation. Even our standard doesn't say anything about that. But you can argue for saying that gradually as you are making use of your equipment, mm-hmm. you are getting more and more value.
So you should therefore allow people in practice to have these gradually increasing depreciations when you buy something, just as you do in alternative B, where you have a progressive scale on your depreciations.
The progressive scale on depreciation is already allowed.
Yes, it is, but not very much used.
Okay. Or in telecoms, yes.
I'm going to give our two B voters a second preference here. So if B's off the table, what would you now say?
C.
B. I think it's in any of these methods, interest is underestimated anyway. We're a long way from comparing true buying with leasing, because you don't take the asset on board. If you're a long way from reality, making a direct comparison possible between UPS and FedEx, typical firms that have both edges, then you should keep it as simple as possible. And I think the approach B will be best understood by most investors, not only the advanced ones.
Okay, and if you can't have B, then you would do A or C?
C.
There we are. Got a majority in the end, eh?
Of course, it's not majority.
I got two mice on my neck. I want to share my biscuit.
Okay, we're going to call it a... Yeah.